So we're good here, ready to go. You may turn to Leviticus chapter 18 tonight. We're continuing our study through the book of Leviticus. As I said at the beginning, I'm not sure exactly how long this study will take us because I haven't laid out a sermon schedule. It's one of these where I've looked at it, and I've struggled back and forth with how much to cover each time. And what I've decided to do is just study week by week and determine how much should be communicated from what I study here. I don't want to bore you with all these details of these weird laws, but this is God's revelation, and there's stuff in here for us that we probably don't spend a lot of time looking at because it's wrapped in this difficult language of all these legal prescripts. So we tend to look at it, and it's foreign to us, and kind of, if we make it through this part of our reading plan, we do it fairly quickly. So I'm not going to rush, but hopefully I won't belabor us too much as well as we go through. If you remember, we shifted last week, was it last week? 2 weeks ago now, into a new section of the book, really the second half of the book of Leviticus. We're into the holiness code. That's why we were singing about holiness tonight. This is the section of the book that deals with holiness code for the nation. Up till now, we introduced mainly things for the worship itself of the nation, how the things were to structure itself within the sanctuary, how the priests were to operate, the sacrificial systems were to be performed. It dealt with the worship aspect of the nation. But the nation is filled with individuals that are to be qualified worshipers. Worship is just not something that they do at one time when they come to the sanctuary center. Worship needs to be prepared for by how they live their lives. God's whole purpose was to create a nation that would be distinct, that would be stand apart from all the nations around to show here's what holiness looks like. So we're in the second half of the book that deals with this aspect of holiness for the individuals. How should they go about their day in and day out lives living in a manner that is holy before God? Well, it should come as no surprise when we get into this section that one of the areas that would be dealt with is sexual purity. Sexual purity is one of the greatest challenges that God's people have continually faced. And we all probably recognize the sexual drive is a strong drive. It's given to us by God as one of God's foremost blessings upon mankind. But it's also an area that Satan has taken and twisted and corrupted and tried to use against God's image bearers to corrupt that image of God. It's become one of the foremost areas of sin over the centuries within humanity. So it should really be no surprise that in this holiness code that there'd be a section dealing with sexual purity. And that's what we're going to look at tonight. God addresses directly what he requires in this area of the nation for holiness. So we're in this section, and in chapter 18 is dealing with these laws that continue to enable the Israelites to live as holy nation. Chapter 18 and 19 really work together in that section 18, chapter 18, I'll get it right yet, chapter 18 is prohibitions. We find a bunch of you shall nots, and in this you shall not is dealing with this area of sexual morality. Chapter 19 is prescriptions, you shall. Here's things that you shall do. And it's interesting that the shall nots deal with sexual immoralities where the you shall deals with idolatry. How many times we see in the Old Testament where God connects idolatry to sexual immorality. There's a tie here between these two. What you shall not do in the area of sexual purity is complemented by what we'll see next week, Lord, or 2 weeks, Lord willing, on how they shall behave as far as worship goes. So we're dealing this area, as I said, in the sexual realm, particularly in areas where they are to be different from the nations around them, the Canaanites that are the current inhabitants of the land. 7 times in this one short chapter, it's repeated that the Israelites are not to behave like the nations who inhabit Canaan before them. When God repeats something 7 times in 30 verses, he's trying to get a point across. You shall be different from them. You shall not be like them. And one of the things that they are to be very distinct in is how they handle their sexuality, the what God calls moral. In Leviticus 18 through 20, the phrase here in those three chapters, "I am the Lord your God," occurs almost 50 times. I am the Lord your God. This is not just opinions. This is not just good ideas. God is stating categorically that he is God, and he has made the rules. He has given them their requirements. I am the Lord your God. Now, because this section from here on out is a little more challenging, I think, for us as we try to figure out how does it apply today. We're very much in an Old Testament context where things are different in our restrictions before God today than they were then. What I've decided to do is vary a little bit here. At the end of our time together this evening, we'll stop the recording so you don't have to worry about that, and I'll open up for questions to make sure that what I've communicated is clear, because I want to make sure that we understand how this applies to us still today. And I realize that that ability of mine to communicate that may be limited, so we'll open up for questions. So as we're going through tonight, if questions come to your mind saying, I don't quite understand that, or I want to understand this better, just remember what that question is for about 25 minutes or so here, and you'll have your opportunity. If you can't remember 25 minutes, you may have to jot it down on a corner of a piece of paper, because you may be like me, and that's ancient history when you go that long. The point here is God is laying out his expectations. I am the Lord your God. Let's begin here as we look at this chapter. The first five verses contain this call to be distinct. Notice the focus here in the first five verses. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, notice what he says right from the beginning, I am the Lord your God. Yahweh, the covenant name of God. I am the Lord your God. Yahweh, your God. You shall not do what is done in the land of Egypt where you lived, nor are you to do what is done in the land of Canaan where I am bringing you. You shall not walk in their statutes. You are to perform my judgments and keep my statutes, to live in accord with them. Why? I am the Lord your God. So you shall keep my statutes and my judgments, by which man shall live if he does them. I am the Lord. I think we can recognize that I'm the Lord is just a shortened form of saying, I am the Lord your God. He is emphasized here three times in these first opening phrases why they should listen. Notice here in verse 2, speak to the sons of Israel. This holiness code, this section is addressed to all the nation. It's not just to the priests, it's not just to Aaron, it's to all the nation. All the Israelites are addressed. And as I've said numerous times, the basis is that Yahweh has spoken. And that even serves as a wrapper on this entire chapter, because if you jump all the way down to verse 30, notice the last words of this chapter as well. I am the Lord your God. Everything within this chapter is wrapped around this idea that Yahweh has spoken. As I said, the entire chapter here focuses really on sexual relations. But he lays out the idea that you're to be different from other nations. You're not to be like Egypt. Remember the context here. They're just coming out of Egypt now. They've crossed the Red Sea. They've made it to Mount Sinai, and God has revealed the law. So is very recent in their past that they come out of Egypt. Very, very recent. So they're not to be like the Egyptians. But they're not to be like the people they're going to encounter if they move on to Canaan too, when they leave Mount Sinai and get to Canaan. They're to be different from all of these nations. That's the center focus here. They're to be distinct. They're to be holy. God employs two verbs here in verse 4 to make this a very strong command. The way it's worded, you are to perform and you're to keep. That strong commands, these are what they are to do. This is how they are. You are to perform my judgments, you're to keep my statutes, to live in accord. The idea of live, or you may have in some versions to walk, is the idea of total obedience. This is to be your way of life. This isn't going to be something you do when you know somebody's watching. This is your way of life. So this is why we've branched out now from what they do when they come to the tabernacle to what they do in the normal course of life. This is how you are to live in your life. They are, if you notice, they are to walk differently than the way the people of Canaan walk. Verse 3, you shall not walk in their statutes. Rather, you are to live or to walk, same word is used in verse 4, according to God's statutes. There's a contrast here. Your life is different from their life because you have different rules governing your life. You have a sovereign creator God who has revealed himself to you and formed this covenant that is brand new that tells you how to behave, how to live holy. So you'd be different from them. You are to live differently. You're not like the pagans. A proper response to all of these laws, as well as the other legislation that's handed down as part of the legal code here, this law, it holds here in verse 5 a promise. If you keep my statutes and my judgment, so you shall keep my statutes by which a man may live if he does them. That the idea of living there is to have an abundant life. God promised a number of blessings if they kept his law. Of course, he promised a number of curses if they do not keep his law. So the idea is to live according to the law, and it would be the way of abundant life. How are we to be faithful to God? They are to know Yahweh, their God. Yahweh is their God. How are they to demonstrate he's their God? What does faithfulness look like? It's very simple. Obedience. Obedience to what he says. Just as Jesus says in the Gospel of John, over and over, he says that obedience and love go hand in hand. You cannot love God if you do not obey. You do not love Jesus if you do not obey. Here, God is saying to the Israelites, if you want to show that you're faithful to me, if you want to show that I am your God, you obey my statutes. You live accordingly. The law then here is designed to enable the nation of Israel to live as God's holy nation, and that is how they'll receive the blessings that he's promised to bless them with. So let's move into the specifics. Verses, three through five are the introduction. Verse 6 begins the details. None of you, this is your first law, none of you shall approach any blood relative of his to uncover nakedness. I am the Lord. We don't get very far without that phrase, do we? I am the Lord. I am Yahweh. I am God. This verse really sums it up. It gives the prohibitions. What we have then following from here through verse 18 are various specifics that fall under this idea to define what is a blood relative or a near relative. There's detailed prohibitions really dealing with incest, marriage or sexual relations between two people who are closely related. And starting in verse 7, it identifies who those people are. But it starts with this general statement of the principle. None of you shall approach any blood relative of his to uncover nakedness. Effectively, what these laws that follow do is limit within the context of the nation who a man may look toward to be his wife. Who's a viable marriage partner? What are the limitations within which he can look for a marriage partner? Yes, he cannot have sexual relations with any of these as well. There is that clear prohibition against sexual immorality. But within the context, it also would deal with marriage. There's many of laws that said that they cannot have sexual relations with those they're not married. So it's doing both things. It's limiting sexual relations with those that are too close in relatives, but it's also saying these are appropriate marriage partners. This would be a particularly important and maybe even problematic law for the nation of Israel. They are not to marry foreigners. That foreigners were outside the realm of who was viable to begin with. And then there's within the nation, as they were going to be inheriting the land, there was an impetus there to marry within your own clan to protect their land inheritance. They did not want to marry from another clan because that could move the inheritance of the land outside their clan to to a foreign, to another clan, not a foreign clan, but another clan. So there was this impotence to keep the land close, the inheritance close, so they would look for close relatives. And with those instincts that would be part of their makeup, it would naturally have been easy to marry too close of a relative. So God's defining, here's the boundaries. Within this boundary, it's too close. He uses this term, we have it translated in the New American Standard, any blood relative. Now, that same term is found in chapter 21, verses 2 and 3, where a priest is told not to touch a dead body unless it's a close blood relative, and defines that term very succinctly there, that a blood relative refers to mother, father, son, daughter, brother, or sister. So we have it wrapped up pretty tightly there, but the rest of this chapter gives us more relationships. He says, do not approach any blood relative to uncover nakedness. That's a unique phrase, a very strange phrase. If you've been in church any length of time, you probably recognize that phrase is a euphemism for sexual relations. It's a euphemism for the actual sexual interaction. But it's a unique phrase to pick up as euphemism. A lot of times, euphemisms come from some association. Uncovering the nakedness seems to tie into the idea of the one flesh relationship that God lays out in Genesis chapter 2, where a man is to leave his wife and they become one flesh. There's a relationship between a man and a wife where the uncovering of the nakedness of one spouse is in essence exposing the partner, the spouse. They're united. There's a oneness there. And that's what we see as we flow through here. To uncover the nakedness of the wife is equivalent of uncovering the nakedness of the husband. There's a connection. The other thing we should recognize is after the fall, nakedness is always associated with shame. So uncovering the nakedness is a reflection of shame. In other words, to violate any of these prohibitions is shameful. It's something to be walked away from. It's something to be avoided. Now, we probably recognize that things have not always been so restrictive in God's legal laws up till this point. There were times earlier where things were not so restrictive. For example, Adam and Eve's children married their siblings. There were no other children. There were no other people. So God did not restrict Adam and Eve's children from marrying their siblings. They had to do that. When we come to Abraham, he married Sarai. And we're told in Genesis chapter 20 that Sarai is his half-sister. And that was clearly a blessed union, as God used them as the foundation for the nation. So we can recognize that things were not always this restrictive, but now God is putting these restrictions in place. And because this will distinguish Israel from the nations around them. These rules serve to protect the family relationships, the family unit. In fact, the relations that we see here seem to be those people who would be living under the same roof in their extended clan context. So we're protecting the family unit, those who lived in a single household within that extended family unit in ancient Israel are not to have sexual relations with one another unless they're husband-wife. And husband-wives are not to be taken from within others that would have grown up in the same household, in the same unit. That could cause all kinds of problems. If you need an example of the kind of problems, just think to Jacob. We have all the lessons of Jacob's 12 sons that come from his four wives as ready-made examples of the problems that come when you marry within too close within the household unit. Jacob's family was a mess. No other way you can describe it when some of the brothers will take a brother and sell him in slavery and tell dad that he was killed. That's pretty much a dysfunctional family. So we have an example here that even in Scripture that would help us understand this. So verses 7 through 18 list the 12 different forbidden relationships. the different relationships, and they list the relative that cannot be married, and then the reason is given. And I'm not going to read through all the verses. They get very repetitive. Verse 7 is an example. It says, "You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father." That is the nakedness of your mother. She is your mother. So you have the relationships that's prohibited. That's having a sexual relation with your mother. The reason? Because she's your mother. You're not to uncover her nakedness. So in verse 7, we have one's mother. In verse 8, we have one's stepmother. In verse 9, it's one sister. And also in verse 9, it's a half-sister. In verse 10, it's a granddaughter. In verse 11, it's a stepsister. In verse 12, it's the paternal aunt. In verse 13, it's a maternal aunt on the mother's side. In verse 14, is the paternal uncle's wife. So your uncle on your dad's side's wife, who could potentially be living in the same clan, in the same household extended unit, if the father was still alive. One's brother's wife is listed in 16. Now, I will mention when it comes to verse 16, where it says, "You shall not uncover the nakedness of your brother's wife," that is your brother's nakedness. We should recognize that that applies specifically while the brother's alive. There is an exception condition. You probably know of the liveret law that says that if a brother dies without giving any offspring, any male offspring that would inherit the land, it was his younger brother's or his brother's responsibility to take his widow, that widow, as a wife to raise up offspring in his name so the inheritance would be preserved. So that would be an exception or a clarification for if a brother dies without an heir, where verse 16 is the general principle. Verse 17 deals with a stepdaughter and also with a step-granddaughter. And then verse 18 is the wife's sister. Notice there is an exception clause on verse 18. "You shall not marry a wife, marry a woman in addition to her sister as a rival while she is alive to uncover her nakedness." So that limits the application of that rule for during a wife's lifetime. After the If a wife died young or early and she had an unmarried sister, that would no longer apply. But this would be a direct prohibition to the situation that you had with Jacob, with Leah there and Rachel. Also, I'm drawing a blank. They'd be a direct violation to this. So those are the relationships that are forbidden that they're listed out here. What is surprising and is noticeably absent from here is the father-daughter relationship. It's not listed that a man cannot marry or have relationships with his own daughter. And some people will raise a question mark because we know that's a very frequent situation of incest. Now, we have to suspect on this, but most scholars, and I think this is a viable reason, suggest that that relationship, a father-daughter relationship, was universally condemned in the cultures of that day. They cannot find any record of any nation of that era that accepted a father-daughter sexual relation. It was universally condemned. So scholars suggest that's why God did not put it in the list. That's a given. Even the nations around them did not practice that. Which kind of brings to mind why Paul would say in the situation in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, where he's dealing with the man who is committing sexual immorality with his father's wife, his stepmother, where Paul says, "This is so heinous, even the pagans do not do this." So God is distinguishing between what is accepted by the pagan nations and what is holy. So the one relationship that is clearly out of bounds by all accounts isn't listed. And I think that's a viable explanation for why it's not here. So that's what we have in the first 18 verses. In verses 19 through 23, we move into other forbidden offenses, primarily of a sexual nature. And these are other types of situations that they are to avoid it, that will distinguish them from other nations. In verse 19, "Also you shall not approach a woman to uncover her nakedness during her menstrual impurity. I moved my eyes and I couldn't find my verse. You shall not have intercourse with your neighbor's wife to be defiled with her. You shall not give any of your offspring to offer them to Molech, nor shall you profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. You shall not lie with a male as one lies with a female. It is an abomination. You shall not have intercourse with any animal to be defiled with it, nor shall any woman stand before an animal to mate with it. It is a perversion. So we have different items. Each verse deals with these other types of offenses. The prohibition, verse 19, deals with sexual relations during menstruation. And it's really a repeat from chapter 15, verse 24, where that was forbidden. Most likely, as we said back there, due to the sacred nature of blood. Blood was to be used for atonement. It was sacred. And that seems to be the driving force there. Verse 20 deals with adultery. And adultery is strictly prohibited. You shall not have intercourse with your neighbor's wife. That's a specific case of adultery, but they've already had the Ten Commandments, Exodus chapter 20, verse 14, you shall not commit adultery. It's a blanket prohibition. But we need to recognize that it's such an important thing that is repeated here because adultery is an assault on the nuclear family. And we see that happening in our society all over the place, where the nuclear family is assaulted through these loose sexual relations, where adultery is being committed in high numbers in our society. So it's an assault against that, and God prohibits it. The prohibition about Molech is quite confusing here in verse 21. It's confusing because of what we know and tied into the context here. What we know about Molech is he was the recognized god of the Ammonites. The Ammonites were some of the people that were being displaced. So he is a recognized god. They are not to sacrifice to other gods. That's a given. We also know from other places in the Old Testament that human sacrifice was part of the worship of Molech. And it was part of the worship that even some of the most evil of Judah's kings did. They sacrificed to Molech their own children. And the phrase that's used to offer, you shall not offer any of your offspring to Molech, is a phrase that's used in that context when it's talked about child sacrifice. So that seems to be what is being prohibited in verse 21. The question that comes to mind is, why is it in this context then? Where everything in this context is dealing with sexual purity and prohibitions about sexual immorality, why is it here? And I'll just be honest, I don't have a good answer. But I'm in good company. None of the scholars I read could come up with a good answer. We do know that God would hate human sacrifice. That would be an absolute violation. God also hates any sort of sexual immorality that would be tied into any sort of religious worship. That would be a violation. If there's a connection here, it's not spelled out. We have to assume it would have been obvious to the nation of Israel. They did live in a context that is very distant from us, 3,500 years distant. So there may be things that they would have intuitively understood that we've lost. But God does say to give any of your offspring, and some will suggest because of the context here, it means to offer your offsprings to serve as temple prostitutes to Molech. That could be a possible translation or interpretation of this. Whatever it is, any involvement with Molech profanes the name of your God. And the idea of profaning the name means it is an atrocity against God. God's name and God's person are one and the same. So you profane the person of God by doing anything that would be associated with another false god. And here's where, again, God throws in that little phrase, why? I am Yahweh. You don't do this because of I am God. I am the one that you worship. I am the one that sets the rules. You simply don't do it. Verse 22 deals with homosexuality. This offense is one that is characterized as an abomination. You shall not lie with a male as one lies with a female. It is characterized as an abomination. an act that is abhorrent or repugnant to the senses. And when we get to chapter 20, we'll see the offense, or the penalty for this offense was death. This was a capital crime. I dealt with this verse as well as chapter 20, verse 13 in the seminar I gave on homosexuality. And in that seminar, I mentioned that God views homosexuality as outside the design norm for human sexuality that he created in Genesis 1 and 2. That's why it's an abomination. In this verse in here in Leviticus, in this section where he's dealing with holiness, in particular, shows that homosexuality deviates from holiness within the area of sexuality. Of all the deviations, though, in this entire chapter, only homosexuality is singled out for a special designation with the word an abomination. We will see later on in verses 24 and following that we have the plural form of abominations. All of these things together are abominations, plural. But the only time in the Old Testament that there's a single act that's called out in the single form, an abomination, this alone is abominable, is homosexuality. The implication is that homosexuality is a specific act that receives specific mention as contrary to God's divine will for human sexuality. And that's because it deviates from God's design of one man and one woman for life. So homosexuality is prohibited. Now in verse 23, we also have bestiality prohibited. It is also an offense that in chapter 20 carries the death penalty. It is another capital crime to have intercourse with any animal. In this case, it is a perversion. That word perversion is a very interesting word in the Hebrew. It literally is a word that means to mix. And what that word indicates is that this practice involves an improper mixing between two different species, two different kinds. God created, he created animals after their kind. He created humans as a kind, and they are to go and multiply according to their kinds in Genesis chapter 1. So this is a mixing of kinds. That's what it means to be a perversion. It's to mix what should not be mixed. It's stepping over the boundaries that God established in Genesis chapter 1 through the very first verses of chapter 2. It's a mixing of kinds, and that is forbidden. So these are various offenses that God strongly prohibits. And the chapter concludes with final warnings of judgment. Look at verse 24. Do not defile yourselves by any of these things. For by all these, the nations which I am casting out before you have become defiled. So it's clear that these are actions that all the nations around them do. For the land has become defiled, therefore I have brought its punishment upon it. So the land has spewed out its inhabitants. But as for you, you are to keep my statutes and my judgments, and shall not do any of these abominations. Neither the native nor the alien who sojourns among you. For the men of the land who had been or have been before you have done all these abominations, and the land has become defiled, so that the land will not spew you out should you defile it, as it spewed out the nation which has been before you. For whoever does any of these abominations, those persons who do so shall be cut off from among their people. Thus you are to keep my charge, that you do not practice any of the abominable customs which have been practiced before you, so as not to defile yourselves with them. I am the Lord your God. So we have a repeat here of the admonition from the beginning that they are to be distinct from the world, they're to be separate from the nations that are around them, particularly in this area of sexual behavior. These are all grouped together as categorically abominations. And we're told there that the Canaanites are guilty of all of these perversions that are listed. And that's why they're being singled out for destruction. Remember, Abraham was told that Israel would go down Egypt and they would remain there until the abominations of Canaan have become complete, until they've run their course. Now they've run their course, and Israel's being brought as God's instrument of judgment upon them, and at the same time as an object lesson to the Israelites, do not do what they did, so that I will not treat you the way I treat them. They have done these abominations. So the land is pictured as vomiting them out, spewing them out. God says they are being removed from its surface because this sin defiles the land itself. Don't defile it when you get there so that this won't happen to you. In verse 25, God says, I have brought this punishment upon it. That word brought is a common word in Hebrew that's frequently we have translated visited. It's the idea that God is visiting, and when that word is used with God, when God says, I visit, it means that there's divine intervention occurring. It's used either for blessing or cursing. When God comes, something happens. That always is the case. When God visits his people, something occurs. He either blesses or he curses. Well, he's visiting the nations of Canaan with curse. He's bringing judgment. He's bringing punishment. But he's also warning the Israelites that let this expulsion of the Canaanites be an example and admonitions. They can anticipate the very same fate if they commit the same sins. If they do it, the land will vomit them out as well. In other words, they'll go into exile. This is why so many times the idea of sexual immorality is linked to the abominations that the Israelites do commit, the sins that they have. The final verse contains a directive addressed specifically to the Israelites. Notice, thus you are to keep my charge. This is to be told to all the nations. God spoke to Moses, said, speak to the sons of Israel back in verse 1. Here, through Moses' mouth, God is speaking directly to the people. You are to keep my charge. You do not practice any of these. Do not defile yourselves. He's warning them to obey him and to shun the practices of the pagans. And then it closes out here with that emphatic authority of God over their lives. I am Yahweh, your God. I have the authority to make these prohibitions. This isn't a negotiation. This isn't a discussion element. This is God speaking. I am the Lord. So what can we learn from this? We live on the other side of the cross. We live in a different dispensation, and we are eternally grateful for what Christ has done. We do not live under the Mosaic law, any aspect of the law. You may hear at times, as I've mentioned early on, that some will say there's various aspects of the law. There's the moral component, there's the civil component, there's the ceremonial components of the law. That's one way of looking at things, and people will say that because there are things about the law that seem to still apply to us, so they'll qualify that as the moral. The reality is the law was a legal code for a nation. It was an all-or-nothing code. We don't get to pick and choose which laws of the United States we want to obey. Well, Israel didn't either. But Canadians do not have to obey any of the laws of the United States unless they're in our country. When they're in Canada, they don't obey any of our laws. There happens to be a lot of laws in Canada that look very similar to our laws. There's a lot of the same things prohibited in Canada. You can't go in, Canadians cannot murder each other any more than Americans can. But they're not obeying American law when they come under punishment for murder. They're coming under Canadian law. Well, that's the idea here. We are not under the law. We are not Israelites. This law is no longer in application to us. But there is a lot of commonality between what God expects of us and what he expected of the nation of Israel. Because God has not changed. He is still a holy God, and he still wants his people to be holy people. How do I know that? Well, a lot of places in the New Testament emphasize that. 1 Peter 2, 9 through 12 is one of them, where Peter now is talking about the church, and he's pulling ideas from the Old Testament where he says, you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. For you were once not a people, but now you are the people of God. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the things in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. The idea of visiting from God. When God comes, they'll have to admit that the idea of Peter saying, when God's come, the people who slander you now will have to admit that you were doing right. God calls us to loyalty to him. That hasn't changed. Even though we're in a different context, that hasn't changed. God still calls us to loyalty because he is still God. He is still the one who makes the rules for his people. And part of what he has said is we are to abstain from fleshly lusts, which wage war against the soul. We are to keep our behavior excellent among the Gentiles. Well, this idea has particular bearing in the area of sexuality. God's laws on sex and marriage are still good because they come from him. He still sets boundaries. He still sets prohibitions around us. Because he is God, and he knows what is best for his creatures. In Proverbs 20, verse 11, Solomon, in his wisdom, says, it is by his deeds that a lad distinguishes himself, if his conduct is pure and right. We can distinguish ourselves by doing what is right, what is pure. And that applies to our sexual energies as well. They need to be subordinated to God's will, just as all of our life must be subordinated to God's will. Well, what is the will of God? 1 Thessalonians 4:3 makes it pretty clear in this regard. For this is the will of God, your sanctification, that is, that you abstain from sexual immorality. We don't have to look too hard to figure out what God wants us to do. The reason we need to be so mindful of this is the same reason that Israel needed to be mindful. What God was warning them of is the pull of the culture around them. He was calling them to be distinct from the culture around them, to stand apart, to be holy. We cannot allow our culture to define what is acceptable in the area of sexual behavior. That is not where we look for what is moral and immoral. Our society is largely driven by its lusts. John says in 1 John 2:16, for all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life is not from the Father, but is from the world. Those around us, our society, our culture is driven by lust. It cannot define what is right and wrong. We must look to God for that. And he has told us what is right and wrong. And it's really pretty simple in our area, in our dispensation. It's pretty simple. God says, outside the bounds of one man and one woman married for life commitment to each other, sexual relations are prohibited. Within that boundary of marriage is a glorious blessing from God to be enjoyed. It's pretty simple. It's only our society that is trying to complicate it by working away at those boundaries, saying, well, one man, one woman doesn't have to be that. Let's change that. Within marriage, no, it doesn't have to be that. It just has to be within commitment. No, it just has to be mutual agreement. They keep trying to erase the boundary, but God made the boundary pretty simple. One man, one woman, married for life. So it's not that we have to think real hard about what is pure and impure, what is moral and immoral. What we do have to do diligently is protect the family unit as God has designed it. We know that a nation cannot exist if the family unit decays. The family is the foundation for society. Our job is to stand against the world around us, be distinct, and show what the family unit looks like, what it is, and how valuable it is. We are to protect it. I also would suggest that we need to recognize that while we are standing for righteousness, we cannot legislate righteous acts. Sometimes I think we get confused to think that we can make people righteous if we put enough legislation in place. Well, all we have to do is read our Old Testament and find out that does not work. God legislated righteousness. The most righteous legal code that has ever existed is what we're looking at here in the books of Leviticus, the rest of the Mosaic Law. It is absolute righteous legal code. Our laws are far from that. And yet, even as God legislated that, until the hearts were changed by God, people rebelled against it. So we cannot legislate legal acts. Righteous acts must flow from a heart that is regenerated by Christ, a heart that has a yearning to please him. So while we stand for righteousness, while we must boldly state, here's what is true, we need to be doing it in a way that is communicating the grace that is offered through Jesus Christ. Because that is the only way that we can expect people to turn from unrighteousness to righteousness. Or as we have here, from darkness, as Peter said, from called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Part of our standing for righteousness is to show that marvelous light of the gospel.